My name is Joseph May. We're in talking in Senator Bricker's office at September 18th, 1974. Senator, we were talking yesterday about this recent article in Prologue, and you had a point that you wanted to make on that. Could hand it to you and...
I don't remember exactly what it was, but I know there was a great deal of reliance based upon separate statements that did not encompass the program or the amendment as it's submitted and its purpose.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very simple purpose in the amendment. After the decision of the Supreme Court at Washington, which held that a treaty can amend or even annul the provisions of the Constitution of the United States as far as our citizens are concerned. The American Bar first discussed this. I discussed it with a lot of federal senators and prepared an amendment known as Senate Resolution Number 1. And the only purpose of it was to see that treaties and executive agreements which had been held by the Supreme Court, equal to the status of treaties, would have to conform to the terms of the Constitution of the United States. In other words, the laws of the Congress are only the supreme law if they're made in pursuance of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Treaties and executive agreements only have to be made under the authority of the United States. And the Supreme Court has said that that means nothing more than the agreement by the executive and the approval by two-thirds of the Senate present in voting, so that a very few people could impose on this country laws in defiance of the Constitution which would annul the acts of Congress, qualify the provisions of the Constitution, annul the constitutions of the states and the laws of the states in the protection, against the protection of the Constitution of the rights of the American people.
Do you think one interpretation I have heard about the one of the purposes,
mm-hmm,
of the Bricker Amendment, of course nothing has any single purpose, but one of the purposes is that this could be interpreted as sort of a states' rights movement to protect the rights of the states, and you know this is the thing.
Well, it does that. Of course, the 10th Amendment was supposed to do that,
uh-huh,
and the Supreme Court evidently pays no attention to the 10th or the 9th and 10th Amendments, which ought to be given equal power with the other amendments to the Constitution. Even if it's a treaty, they ought to superimpose that power on the treaties. But they took it away. And it would restore to the states their proper sphere of legislation and of power within the federal system. And that was one of the purposes of it. It was always interpreted that way until Justice Holman, his opinion in Missouri against Holland. And the founders of the drafters of the Constitution never dreamed that it would be interpreted as has been. One man, I think maybe it was Madison, said that if this is the interpretation of the Constitution that we're now living under, we have no Constitution at all. It might have been Jefferson, I'd have to look up my notes, but one of the two of them made that remark. And the Federalist shows all the way through that that was the intention. The phrase, all treaties made or hereafter to be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, was only meant to cover those things which are in international relationships to other countries. Now, when this amendment was drafted, there were only two or three countries, and very small ones, that ever made a treaty the supreme law of the land. It took legislation to do it. And if it had required legislation of the Congress or legislation of the states in order to implement a treaty, there would be no great objection to it. I'd have none, because the states and the Congress act in pursuance to the Constitution. It was a simple...
Well, that, of course, raised the question of the 48 states argument, which came up in 53, mm-hmm, the emergency, the which clause. Now, do you feel that it would have required a treaty to be that affected state law in any way? Would have required passage or action by each of the...
If it were states? Within the province of the state. That's right, and ought to be. That's what it was, what it was intended to be.
Well, let's take a hypothetical case. And in fact, I think there is such a convention, but I can't quote it to mm-hmm. you. But let's say a international convention to provide for respect of driver's licenses. There must be such a convention, because when I visited Germany couple years ago, all I had to do is to apply at the local AAA for a German driver's license for the period of time I was in Germany. The fact that I had an Ohio license entitled me to drive in Germany. And in fact, there was a convention that Germany was not a member of, as I recall reading the phrase on the thing, but that it honored. Now, taking this as a thing, this kind of convention, would it require, let's say you're entering into such a convention, would it require action by each of the states to say that any agreement that we enter into with any foreign country giving aliens the right to acquire Ohio driver's licenses will be honored in Ohio?
I think it ought to be. I think it ought to be. That's the intent of the federal system.
Uh-huh.
We don't have a unified government like they have in Germany or most of the continents. Now, in Germany, that would have to be ratified by the Parliament of Germany, or whatever it's called. Which speaks for the whole country. In this case, the licenses for an automobile are authorized by the states. And here it would be authorized by Congress instead of by the states.
Would that have prevented then such a convention if, say, 47, or now it's 50 states, 49 of the 50 states went along with it, but in one state, for some reason or another, they would not implement this?
Mm-hmm.
Would that have defeated then the convention for all of
no,
the states?
No, it would practically approve the convention. If 40 states approved it, there would only be one left.
Uh-huh.
And any foreigner traveling over the country wouldn't have any trouble staying out of one state, I wouldn't think. I'd rather see that than to see a violation of the intent of the Constitution of the United States.
You were talking yesterday about some very interesting conversations you had with Eisenhower. That was, interested me. Could you tell me at the beginning about how many times did you meet with Eisenhower?
15 or 20.
Goodness.
Yeah.
15 or 20 times?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
all
time and time
again.
Time and time again. I was down, down to the office. I think they were all held there. And in addition to that, I had many conferences with Brownell and with Dulles about it. And they both agreed to the intent of it. And I said to Dulles then, I said, you write it. He said, I don't have the time. And I told him that if he got in bed with some of the people who were opposing it, he'd get lice on him. And he didn't like that very well, because he didn't have a very keen sense of humor anyway.
But, he didn't laugh at that.
No, he didn't laugh at that. But I was with another cabinet member when he, when I was talking to him. And I said, do you want a treaty to violate the laws of the United States or to violate the Constitution? No. Well, I said, that's all I ask of you. You draft it. And that's when he said he didn't have the time.
Well, do you suppose you could pin that down as to date? Do you have any idea? Was that in 53 or 54?
Oh, no. That was just a few weeks or months before the vote came. It was after Eisenhower had the letter from John McCloy.
Yes.
After that.
That was
the last
that,
time
that would be December then, December 1953.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that I have the exact dates. I never kept any notes on the conferences I held. Because I felt they were truthful, and I was, and we talked to each other freely, and we had no tapes.
That was the day before the tape.
No, they were before the tape. We didn't have any. But an interesting thing came up. The last conference I had with Eisenhower, after he had written the letter, and I don't know whether he knew I had a copy of it or not, But after he wrote to John McCloy, I went to see him. I wasn't very friendly, and he knew it. And he said, you know, if this amendment passes, we couldn't enter into an international contract to completely disarm the people of this country. I said, my God, Mr. President, you don't intend to do away with the National Guard, do you? And that, he couldn't answer. That's when he told Carl Mundt that he couldn't talk to me anymore. He said he pushes me in the corner and I can't answer him.
He told that to Mundt?
He told Carl Mundt that. Carl told me. And so after that, Jack Martin was in there, and Jack really favored my position. Always did.
Jack was his an administrative assistant?
Well, he was an assistant in the office. I think it was a little after the governor of New Hampshire left Adams.
Sherman Adams. Yeah.
Sherman Adams. I think it was after he left that Jack moved in there, and after Bob Taft died. He was Bob Taft's administrative assistant.
Oh, I see.
Came from Cincinnati. And then it was later appointed to one of the courts in Washington. I remember I went down and testified for him when he was before the Senate. And he made a lot of other remarks, not as absurd as that one, but a lot of other remarks that showed they were being pumped this stuff by Dulles, because I had Dulles several times use the expressions. Then Dulles came into a meeting one day and said, I've got an announcement to make. Here's what we ought to do. And he read a paragraph from a speech of Chief Justice Hughes. And I said, my Lord, you don't intend to put a public speech into the Constitution of the United States, do you? And, he had no answer to that. I said, that thing that you read is in the Congressional Record twice that I put in myself. And he said, I just found this when he came in. It was Hughes' statement to the effect that if we didn't have the federal system of government, our states' rights were not protected, that we'd have to have something in the place of it that would hold the situation as it was. And he never came up with anything constructive at any time that I can remember. And Brownell was tractable, but Brownell, when I talked to him, I think the second or third time, didn't even know that the provision was in the platform of the Republican Party. And I didn't put it in. Gene Milligan put it in. And Gene didn't even sign my resolution. But
and
he voted
Dulles
for
agreed
it.
To that, too.
Huh?
Dulles agreed to that. This was the 52.
Yeah.
Platform.
Yeah.
He was on the committee
which
tried to reconcile.
Yeah.
So,
and then he came down.
He was father of that wording as much as Milligan.
Now, the which clause, I never thought was important. It wasn't in my first draft. I only put it in at the insistence of the American Bar Association committee. And Al Shreppy was really the author of it. And I thought if we just protect the Constitution, it'll accomplish everything that a which clause would. And it would, in my judgment.
But Shreppy insisted on that which clause for the longest time, as I gather.
Oh, all the way through.
Yeah.
All the way through.
He felt that you just simply saying that you can't conflict, that a treaty can't conflict with this Constitution or even any provision of this Constitution, that this wasn't satisfactory.
He thought it wasn't satisfactory. This strengthened it. And he had a personal pride in it.
I see.
And he thought that that put the clincher on. Which it would have done, it would have strengthened the whole amendment, but it wasn't meaningful. It didn't have anything to do with the substance of it at all. In fact, we discussed that in the office at length before we didn't put it in. We knew what the American Bar had recommended.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was in the ABA proposal, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sandra, would you mind if I close the door?
Right there.
You got a reverberation out there.
Yeah, I'm afraid it might go into the tape a little bit. Well, by the way, I came across in one of the suggested amendments from William Simon. Is that the same William Simon who is Secretary of Treasury today?
I don't know. I never knew him before.
I see.
I have no recollection.
Well, the words, his name was spelled exactly the same way, and
It might have been. I don't know, because the New Yorkers were, the so-called establishment of New York, were largely against the only bar association in the United States that opposed it.
Mm-hmm.
The only one.
Well, do you think that the treaty accomplished, your fight accomplished, even though you did not succeed in getting the amendment passed, do you feel that there was anything accomplished by the fight itself in reaching your goals?
I hope so. President Eisenhower told me after the vote, even, he said, I will never submit a treaty or an executive agreement that doesn't comply with the purpose of your amendment, either legally or in spirit. And he never did. The only time it's been violated since was when Dick Nixon approved the Genocide Convention. And I wrote him about that, and this hasn't been published that I know of in any way, but I wrote the president about it, mm-hmm. and how I felt about it. And I still think it was the most dangerous thing to do. It was the beginning of world government, what it amounted to, and the people proposing it felt that way. And that's what they wanted. Well, anyway, I got a letter back, not from the president, but from the Justice Department. And it said, since Congress could pass this law, that we might as well do it by treaty. I wrote him a pretty stiff letter. And I said, if you haven't time to brief your cases and don't know what you're talking about, I'll do it for you. I never heard from it. It was signed by Rehnquist, who's now on the Supreme Court. He hadn't done it, an understudy had just sat down and told it, we want to support it, been told that. And he'd written it, and I know a reason I never revealed it from the hearing on Rehnquist's stuff was because I knew that he hadn't studied it at all, and had time to.
Well, it was treated, your letter was treated just like any constituent. Just like any constituents.
Just passed it by because the administration was for it. Now, that's what amounted to. And didn't have any reason. And I wrote him and told him, I said, I have no objection to Congress passing it. Nobody's in favor of genocide. Certainly I'm not. And certainly this country's not. But I said, when you superimpose that and send people from America to a foreign court to be tried with no protection from executive clemency, with no right of trial by jury, with no right to an indictment, then you're going beyond your province. And that's what it would have amounted to. Some countries of the world, for stealing, they cut your hand off. Turkey did it at that time.
Well, they have a number of Americans in rather stiff sentences.
Yeah, right now.
Right now. Of course, some of it was for drug violations, but on the other hand,
the Status of Forces Treaty did that. I opposed the Status of Forces Treaty. I said, we're over there to help them. And as long as they are, they ought to be under the jurisdiction of the United States military courts. Now, they might have been tougher on them than maybe the local courts were, but that doesn't make any difference. They had their rights to a hearing and a trial and a right to a pardon by the president, which is protected by the Constitution of the United States. And they were taken away from them. Now, I'll admit this, that there were no heinous punishments administered, so far as I know, on any of our soldiers who were over there. Some of them were incarcerated longer than they should have been without any trials. But that was about all. And yet, in principle, it was wrong. Entirely wrong. Now, if we'd been defending our own shores, they'd have had all those rights. But we sent them abroad to help somebody else, mm-hmm. as every army we've sent abroad has been, that's been its purpose. And then to give the local jurisdiction over them in the commission of crime or anything else, to my mind, was just wrong in principle. Mm-hmm.
Senator, if you had to pick out one of just one person who is one of the major opponents of the Brinker Amendment in Congress, or who you might say was one of your most effective opponents, who do you think would you pick out?
President of the United States.
Oh, President Eisenhower.
Yeah. He's the one who changed it. I had the votes. And when he came out against it, he had three men in the cloakroom that Ed was voted on.
Buttonholing senators. From the White House staff.
And I think there was only one that voted, that changed his vote, that ever came back to the Senate. On either side.
Is that right?
Ferguson was one of the outstanding ones. Because Ferguson got up and made a very emotional speech for the principal. And yet he was against the one thing in it that said that the Congress or Senate, in ratifying a treaty, could annul state laws. I said, well, Homer, let's get this thing through and get it over in the House, and then in conference we can settle it. Mm-hmm. But he made his speech and voted against it.
Now, this was the George text on February 20th, the last one, or was this the
last one? That was, yeah. It wasn't in mine. That was never in mine at all, because I believe in the rights of the states. I believe in local government. And when you bring everything to Washington, you've got a step toward tyranny. And we're moving pretty fast in that direction.
One senator, I've read Senator Douglas's memoirs, came out a year or so ago, and he makes an interesting claim in this. He claims he defeated the George Amendment.
Well, Douglas was a
he
strange.
Said he was going to vote for it,
yeah.
And then had even told George he was going to vote for it.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the last minute he saw that it had symbolic importance, and so he went over and told George. He says, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to break my promise, and then turned right around and voted against it.
Yeah, well, he might have done that, but any one vote
that's right.
Would have done it.
With one vote difference,
yeah.
Why any...
Yeah.
Any
that's what I told Wayne Morris out in Oregon when he said, when I came to the Senate, John tried to teach me something, and I didn't have sense enough to follow him, and he said, I want to say here for public purposes that he was right on the amendment and I was wrong. And I said, Wayne, you could have changed it. He said, that's what makes it hurt. Of course, he was a candidate at that time.
When was that? Was that
That was when he was a candidate before, 4 years, 6 years ago.
6 years ago.
I was out there for the dedication of the football field.
Uh-huh.
I went out of the team. I was chairman of the board of school at the time. That was the last year of my last term.
Well, I have a letter from Fulbright who says the same thing, in essence, that he would have changed. He wouldn't say what wording.
Well, Fulbright never talked to me, but Dick, the great senator from Georgia.
Russell?
Dick Russell,
mm-hmm.
Who was for it strongly, had me down to speak to their bar.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Russell told me that Fulbright had told him I was right. No, I never talked to Fulbright myself, but Dick Russell did tell me that. And there was another one that told me after it ever came up again he'd support it, and that was Senator Neely from West Virginia.
Neely was. You know, when I had an interview with you before, you mentioned that there was a senator, I'm not interested in the names or anything, but you said it was a senator who was so drunk. It was brought in by Bobby Baker. This is the time of February 20th vote.
Yeah.
And was propped up and brought in to vote to defeat me.
Taken back out and put to bed again.
Is that right?
He never knew what he was voting on any more than the man in the moon.
For heaven's sake.
And that was the vote. That's the one that did it. We had won up at that time 60-30.
Yeah.
And Bobby Baker went out and stirred him up and brought him in.
It was quite a thing. In retrospect, looking back on the thing, the climax seems to have been that vote in February 20th, 1954, because the Bricker Amendment never really came closer.
No,
passage,
no, and as I said, Lyndon Johnson seemed more interested in getting a Democrat's name on it than anything else. I always felt that, because I had talked to Walter George about every provision of yours which he concurred, and I did afterwards, too. The last one he approved, even after the vote was taken, and we submitted it again, you know, and he approved of it. There were two votes out at the time. One of them was from a senator from Missouri who is still there, and the other was Stiles Bridges, from New Hampshire. And Stiles was for me. I couldn't get the other man to commit himself. He said, my papers are against St. Louis. That was the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I think. Mm-hmm. And they're controlled out of New York, as you may know. And he said, I think there's a lot to be said for it. But that's as far as he'd go. Well, it didn't do me any good unless I could get two to overcome the one. It takes 2/3 of the vote of the Senate. So we had a motion for a rehearing. We could have gotten that passed. There isn't any question about it. That only takes a majority. But
it was filed by Senator Lennon of North Carolina.
Huh?
Yeah, that was filed by Senator Lennon of North Carolina. He was going to file a motion
March
54.
Yeah. And but I wanted to be assured that it would pass if it came up again. I didn't want to go through the experience that I'd gone through before, because I'd worked on this for 4 or 5 years. And Dirksen had introduced it again, but he never pressed it. It takes a lot of hard work. We presented one time 400,000 names to the Senate in favor of it.
My goodness.
400,000.
Was that compiled by the Vigilant Women for the Bridge Amendment? And at that meeting in Washington, I think in January?
Well, that's where it started.
Uh-huh.
They took them back home and got them sent in. And there was a lot of sentiment. The country was for it. There isn't any doubt about that. Because this Constitution could be amended if the people wanted it amended. They wanted to pass an amendment, give the Supreme Court the right to annul it. They could do it.
Well, don't you think, though, that the legalities of the thing, the technicalities of it, were as confusing to the general public?
Not as much as it was confusing to some of the Senate. There were senators that made absurd statements down there on the floor, showing that they didn't understand what it was all about. And Dulles was guilty of some of them. At one time, if you read those records, at one time he said that you couldn't even build a privy in France.
Yeah, I read that, yeah.
You know, silly as it can be. Because that comes under military law in the first place, and second place it's in a foreign country, and it didn't affect the foreign countries at all. My amendment was never intended to.
Well, that was in relationship to you. I think somebody asked him how many executive agreements do we have in relationship to the NATO treaty? And he replied, about 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you want me to bring them down to you to show you all of them? He says, no, I'm not interested in that. And he says, well, we have 10,000 of them. And he says, you can't even build a privy without an executive
agreement. Well, of course, my amendment wouldn't have affected that at all, because it was an international affair.
Mm-hmm.
All I was doing was protect the American people under the Constitution to their rights, not foreign countries, not troops on foreign soil or anything of that kind. It wouldn't have had any effect on that.
Well, now, wait a minute. It would have had, though, wouldn't it, concerning the criminal jurisdiction, the executive agreements in relationship to our foreign troops? And
well, I doubt that. I doubt that. You mean the...
what types of crimes the country would agree to turn over for court-martial
mm-hmm.
trial, what types they would retain jurisdiction on?
I don't think that would have affected them at all, because that's an international affair. I was only dealing with national affairs here in this country. All I intended to do. You mean the status of forces?
Yeah, under status of forces, yeah.
Well, I don't think it would have prevented it. I did at the time, and I so testified and so spoke on the Senate of that effect.
But then if it wouldn't have affected them in that respect, would it have provided protection for our troops in giving them a fair trial?
Under military law, you could have the only way.
Well, what about those crimes, though, that were...
committed outside the military?
Right.
It wouldn't have changed that. You could still have status force treatment, I think, without a doubt. Because there's nothing constitutional to the contrary.
Mm-hmm. You said, and Professor Rankard quoted you, question of who is your principal opponent, you said Eisenhower. Now, was it Eisenhower himself?
No, it was Dulles and the Attorney General.
And so it was Dulles and Brownell who you think...
Kept prompting him.
Persuaded Eisenhower.
Yeah, because I had talked to them long enough to know that they were. I knew what arguments they were using and so forth. And the man that's mentioned in here that was an assistant to Dulles was also their correspondent in California from Cromwell and Sullivan, mm-hmm. who Dulles presumably headed. And he would make, he beat the table on it, all kinds of absurd statements to the State Department.
Are you referring to Flager?
Flager, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Flager.
And he was the one who made the statement from the president to the president that we couldn't enter into any of these treaties with other countries for of goodwill and trade, mm-hmm. commerce. Mm-hmm. And that's when I told him he didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't. He didn't. He was there for one purpose. That's all.
Do you remember, I know it's difficult to ask you about specific times because...
No, I can't remember dates.
Dates or anything, but... At the beginning of 1953, just at the beginning of the session, before Eisenhower was inaugurated, when he had his hotel, in, his headquarters in the Commodore Hotel in New York, just before you were introduced, Senate Joint Resolution 1, you called up President Eisenhower.
No, Foster Dulles called me.
Oh, Foster Dulles called you?
Yeah.
You didn't call him?
I have no recollection. Oh, no, I didn't call Foster, no.
Well...
And asked me not to introduce him.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I said, well, Foster, I've been for this, and it's right, and I'm going to file it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, now, this was a little bit later. I think before this time, one account that I have, on January 7th, I think it was, January 6th or 7th, 1953, this is before Eisenhower became president, that he received a call from you, and... Dulles and Flager and several other people, I don't recall, were in the room when Eisenhower got this call. And he talked to you for a while. And then he, according to the account that I have, he put his hand over the telephone and had a conference right there in the room before he answered you. In other words, he says, excuse me just a minute, or whatever he said, you know, and had a conference before he answered you. And according to what I got was, he said to the fellows in the room, talking to Dulles, he says, Senator Bricker wants me to join in recommending that the Bricker Amendment be passed. What do you guys think about this? And Dulles said, turned to Flager and says, well, you know more about it than I do. What do you think?
Well, he didn't know much about it, I'll say that.
No, at that time.
I have no recollection of calling Eisenhower before the president. Uh-huh. I did have breakfast with him.
Oh, is that right?
Along uh-huh. with four or five other senators at the White House. And this was taken up. Explained all the way through.
That must have been later on in the year.
It was within the first month or two after he was president.
Yeah.
He called all the senators down. And I was in a group. The only one I remember expressly was there was from Utah. He's now gone.
Watkins.
Huh?
Watkins.
Watkins.
Yeah.
And I suppose I could reconstruct it, but I told him all this whole story, whatever it means, as I've talked to you here about it. And Eisenhower said, I'll put my sword and sidearms on for it. That's the expression he used.
Now, wait a minute. For the Bricker Amendment?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I'll put my sword and
sidearms on for it. It's,
well, that's pretty strong for a military.
It's good Republican doctrine. It's in our platform. And it's good constitutional law.
Well, he wasn't necessarily referring to the wording of your text, though. He might have been referring to the
principle.
It was
all discussed, and the wording was right there on the table. So I must not have talked to him beforehand. I'm confident I didn't. because I don't think I ever called him in my life outside of it in the White House.
Well, could it have been perhaps a call by Mr. Webb on your behalf, trying to line up support?
I don't think Chuck would ever do that unless he talked to me about it.
Uh-huh.
I'm quite confident. I would say positively, with the exception of my memory might fail me, I'd say positively that I never called Eisenhower and never asked him until he became president of the United States.
Well, this was just, he was going to become president about 20 days after this occurred, mm-hmm. so...
Well, we wouldn't have had the conference and he wouldn't have said to me what he did, that I'll put my sword and sidearms on for this one. If he had been advised not to do it by Dulles and by Flager. I don't know that Flager had even been appointed then.
Now, you say this was a couple of months after he was inaugurated.
Well, it was someplace, it might have been the first month. I don't
first know. Month.
Yeah, it was right after he became president, when he was getting his program outlined and so forth.
Well, Flager was designated and Dulles was designated at that point. But,
Dulles called me and asked me not to file it.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember that very definitely. And I told him I was going to. I said, I believe in it, and I'm going to put it to a vote if I can possibly get it out. Mm-hmm. And I worked for months to get it out. I even went before the Republican Congress. And the chairman, and it had been held up in the Judiciary Committee. And the chairman came to me and said, I was asked to hold this up. And I said, who asked you? And he told me. Well, I'll tell you who it was if you turn this off.
Sure, okay.
But he never talked to me about it. He had to vote for it. He knew that. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Don't publish that as coming from me. But Bobby's in the Senate.
Oh, yeah.
After all, Bob and I were good friends. And we were together almost every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I never knew why. Except he might have wanted to amend it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Stiles Bridges one time said he was for anything he could amend.
So there'd be a Bridges amendment. You know, Vandenberg was that way too.
Yeah, no, he said about the other fellow. Yeah. Not by himself, he said about the other
fellow. Oh, I see. Well, you know, this, in a way, poses a problem of interpretation. You know, I find that as a historian, getting the facts isn't nearly as difficult as trying to make sense of them.
Yeah.
And
doing what is done in this article that you showed me, where you pick out phrases and letters and telegrams and the like, which may be on a single point, or may it be at a different time into consideration. Now, President Truman was against it. I don't know the
He was against it flat-footed. He didn't make any flat-footed. He didn't make any bones about being against it.
No, and so was Stevenson, who was the candidate to succeed him. And of course, I didn't pay much attention to him because there was nothing he could do about it with Truman. And it was put in a platform without my request or having anything to do with it.
Well, this raises the question of Eisenhower. How do I interpret Eisenhower? Was he managing you?
Eisenhower?
Mm-hmm.
Was he never
trying
did.
To, no, what I mean there. I know he didn't succeed, but was he trying to...
He was trying to defeat the amendment because he was told by the establishment in New York through Dulles and through Bonnell that they didn't dare let it pass, it would degrade his standing among the nations of the world. Mm-hmm. And that's when I told him that you'll be degraded among the people of this country forever if you succeed in defeating this.
Well, what I mean is, I don't know how to put it gently, or do you think Eisenhower was sincere when he said he would put his sword on and his sword?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. And he told me even after the defeat, there's something like this ought to be passed. And if we'd have had time to sit down and consult on it and work it out, we could have done it. And Sherm Adams tried to say that in his book. Well, there wasn't any truth in Sherm Adams' statement. I know that. And I don't know what Sherm had to do with it, except that I did ask Sherm one time that if they put the same provision in the new platform that they put in the one 4 years before, that I'd be satisfied. And he said, certainly that's all right, and I'll do it. And the chairman of the committee told me that he'd lose his right arm rather than do it. And then they changed it. I was told, now this is only hearsay, I was told that Eisenhower called up the convention and said if they didn't put his wording in it, that he wouldn't be a candidate.
And this was in 56?
Yeah. I was told that by a man from the State Department. Now, whether it was true or not, I don't know. Nobody would admit it. Nobody would admit it.
Well, and you really think that Eisenhower wanted an amendment?
He did in the very beginning. There isn't any doubt about it.
In the beginning, he wanted
it. Oh, there isn't any doubt about it. No, or he wouldn't have said what he said. And he had no excuse that he didn't know what it was, because it was thoroughly explained and discussed by five senators and the president around his own breakfast table. And then we had another meeting with the cabinet. There were only two members of the cabinet against it.
Only two members of the cabinet against it. But only one member of the cabinet spoke up for it. And that was Mannion.
Who?
Mannion.
He wasn't in the cabinet.
Well, he had a cabinet level.
And he got fired for doing it.
Yes, he did. He got fired for doing it.
After the president told him, very frankly, according to what Clarence told me, or Dean Mannion always.
Dean Mannion, yes.
That he could take any position on that that he wanted to.
He said that in a cabinet meeting.
Right through, yes.
He said that in a cabinet meeting, that you could take any position that you wanted to take, only check with the State Department first.
Well, if he said that, I don't know. Because I remember I was in a meeting when Frank Holman told Dean Mannion that if he did it, he said they'll fire you. And Dean says they don't dare if they did.
Well, Humphrey, on two occasions, he said, one time, that he tried to work out a compromise, which served as a sort of an emissary between the administration and you, trying to work out an acceptable compromise. Do you recall this?
I don't recall anything that Humphrey had to do with it.
Well, he said had very little to do with it. That was just all he, just two occasions he spoke to you.
Yeah, now we did have a meeting that included Lyndon Johnson and Dick Russell, Homer Ferguson, and about a half a dozen others that tried to work something out, and they got something that was satisfactory to me. And I so said, but I said, I want the word from Eisenhower that he's not going to oppose this.
Now, Homer, this was in 55 or after the
55? Yeah. Uh-huh. And Homer Ferguson says, I'll confer with him and find out. And Homer said he couldn't get a commitment.
Now, that must have been 54, because the Ferguson, it could have been 55.
Yeah, Ferguson lost in the next election.
That's right.
But it was before before he was out of the Senate.
And you couldn't get a commitment from Eisenhower, but it was satisfactory now, you say, to Ferguson?
Satisfactory to me and everybody there.
Johnson and Russell?
Yeah. Now, I haven't the wording of it, because I don't know whether there's a copy of it any place or not. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't keep them record for any purpose at all, never did. This was interested in the legislation.
So, getting back to Eisenhower, I don't want to, run this horse, but it is important exactly what Eisenhower's role in this was. You take the line taken in Reichert's article. He is rebutting a school of thought that existed before this time, that Eisenhower was this non-political, above politics, the type of president. He said it's not so, that Eisenhower was a very much political
man. Yeah, he had, he was enamored of big businessmen and of big bankers, especially in the East.
Mm-hmm.
They had more influence over him than anybody else.
The Eastern establishment.
Yeah, more influence over him. Why, I'll never know. Because he didn't owe anything to him. He was elected from here on to the West.
But in his handling of this thing, you know, you could say that Eisenhower's handling of it was rather shrewd.
Rather what?
Shrewd.
Oh, yes, he had that New York establishment. He got one vote. Uh-huh. One vote more than he needed.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, I get the impression, though, even so, that if he could have gotten an amendment just restricted to the Nolan substitute, shall we say, something like that.
Well, the Nolan substitute came right out of the mouth of Foster Dulles, who came down before, and I was in the meeting, came down before the Foreign Relations Committee and proposed just that thing. Supreme Court involved in it, and so forth, which is perfectly absurd.
You mean overturn the political questions doctrine?
And I made a speech on the floor against him about just what it meant,
and they never brought it up again, never mentioned it.
Was that simply to overcomplicate the matter?
That's all.
You didn't have any real problems?
No, it was just tricky, not with the Nolan amendment. Nolan supported my amendment right down to the bitter end. Left the chair of the leadership and went back and took another seat and made a speech for him.
But yet he permitted himself to be the mouthpiece of the administration.
That's right.